I don't buy that argument that this is growing the economy when people are putting their money in stocks.
Well, let me ask about a related...
I feel like we needed way more of an explanation there.
Donald Trump has this one neat trick. He will blame every problem you have on an immigrant. You're out of a job, immigrant took your job. Out of healthcare, immigrant took your healthcare. True. Out of housing, immigrants living in a house, you should have...
Like, that's true. Republicans like simple problems for complex things. Liberals have complained about this for a long time. They could have easy answers for everything. It's like, okay.
We have a far better set of answers.
Okay.
Which is, if you're out of a job, it's probably because a corporation figured out how to offshore automate your job. I mean, think about AI.
People corporations.
If you're out of a home, it's probably because a corporation is speculating on the home
people
that you probably should have been able to afford. If you're out of healthcare, it's because a corporation is definitely figuring out how to monetize you because you get sick.
Like this dance from brain rot position to brain rot position, and people like this is all just different forms of populism where you just like identify some fucking enemy that's destroying everything in your life, and the simple answer is to get rid of all the enemies. It's just like, it's so brain rotty. How much is this going to trigger me?
April 15th was, as you may know, tax day here in the U.S. If you're a normal American, you make money through wages, probably not your favorite day of the year. If you make a median income or above, you're handing a lot of that money back to the government. But that is the price we pay for living in a society. Right? Right? Well, not for everyone. You may remember this. In 2021, ProPublica published an investigation built on a bunch of leaked tax documents revealing what the richest Americans really pay or don't.
God, this is such a stupid fucking analysis by ProPublica. This, everybody got super fucking infuriated about these tax rates or whatever, because they were like the wealthy elites only pay like 1.5%, but they were doing it like they were doing the income tax you pay as a function of your overall wealth, but nobody calculates your taxes that way. Like, if I made like $100 last year, but I have a house worth $1 million and I pay $10 in taxes, nobody would say that I made 0.001% or that I paid 0.001% of my taxes, because that's a function of my income versus my wealth. Like, it was just a really weird, stupid analysis. But that, not to say that there's not a point to be made about people that are super wealthy or whatever, but this is such a dumb comparison.
Warren Buffett had a true tax rate of 0.1%. Jeff Bezos, 0.98%.
Like, this is not true. As a percentage of your wealth, but we don't ever calculate taxes as a percentage of wealth. Nobody thinks about their tax liability that way. Literally nobody.
Michael Bloomberg, 1.3%. And we don't get to see their tax documents year on year, but what they're doing, we kind of know what it is and how it works. So what is it and how does it work and what can we do about it? Ray Madoff is a professor at Boston College Law School who specializes in tax law and estate planning and is the author of Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. She knows how broken the tax system is, partially because she has helped the rich navigate it, and she has some ideas for how to fix it. As always, my email, ezraclancho@nytimes.com. Ray Madoff, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ezra. Wonderful to be here.
So, tax day just passed. A lot of us were doing our taxes here in the final couple of days.
Are they supposed to analyze it? Well, you analyze the income tax you pay against your income. What do you mean? Like, that's the same way that everybody else does. If you have a problem with people accruing massive amounts of wealth because of the increase in value of like the companies they own or whatever, I feel like that's a legitimate criticism to have. I think that there are good questions to be asked about that. I just don't know what. Like, we're not even close to having the conversation of what the appropriate vehicle would be to tax those types of things, because these people just, the analysis starts off stupid. Like, what is the income tax you pay as a percentage of your total wealth? And then it's like, well, what do we do about it? I guess wealth taxes. Like, okay, can we have a serious discussion about like what how do we capture some of this money in the form of like government revenue, right?
Naming any names. But let's start here. If you're a normal person, what kind of,
do you think the average American gets taxed at 1.5% of their wealth though? Probably not. The average American's wealth is probably considerably lower than like a billionaire. But the average income tax you pay as a percentage of your wealth probably drops significantly as you get older, right? Because wealth is pretty going to be tracked highly functional of your age. The older you get, the wealthier you are. I don't know what the average like Social Security tax rate is, though. Or I guess now those motherfuckers don't pay any tax on Social Security, right? Didn't Trump just get rid of that? Fuck, I don't know. For some retired people, they might be paying a 1% or less tax rate. Who the fuck knows? If you're comparing it versus your wealth, but that's just such a weird way to compare things.
Doing our taxes here in the final couple of days, not naming any names. But let's start here. If you're a normal person, what kind of taxes do you pay?
You pay a lot of taxes. Here's the thing. Americans, anyone who has a job or anyone who works for a living, either for themselves or for others, pays significant taxes. They pay income taxes at rates up to 37%. In addition, they pay payroll taxes that are as high as 15.3%. And together, it's a pretty significant liability. So what this...
Your payroll taxes should be about 7... Is it like 7.7%? Because FICA is only half of that, unless you're doing a different schedule for a small business owner or whatever. But most people are not 1099 small business owners. So most people are only going to be paying half of what the 15% rate is. I don't know what the 37% bracket is. I don't know how high you have to be for that. But
means is that high-paying, high-earning Americans pay lots and lots of taxes, but all earning Americans pay something in taxes.
How does this fit with the statistic people might have heard, which is that our tax code is very, very progressive, almost ridiculously so in this telling, that 40% of people pay no income taxes, and then the top 1% pay 40% of the income taxes. When you hear that, that sounds like a very soak the rich kind of code.
Absolutely. And the problem with that statistic is it's misleading on both ends. So let's start first with the 40% of non-payers. This was, you might have heard this in terms of Mitt Romney talking about the 47%, which is what it was when he was running for office, and he was caught on a hot mic saying 47% of Americans are non-payers, and therefore, you know, they'll never vote for me because they're just takers, not makers.
There are 47% of the people who vote for the president, not well. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they're victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement. These are people who pay no income tax. 47% of Americans pay no income tax.
The thing that he didn't account for is the tremendous burden imposed by payroll taxes. And even though 40% of Americans don't pay any income taxes, they still pay significant payroll taxes. Indeed, today I just read a statistic that 80% of Americans pay more in payroll taxes than they pay in income taxes.
Sure. That's not surprising at all, though, because I don't think your standard deduction hits the payroll taxes. I don't think those get counted. So if you have, if you're an individual, you make $15,000. What is the standard deduction now? Isn't it like $16K? If you pay the $16K, if you're under that standard deduction threshold, you're not going to be paying anything in federal income tax, but you are going to have your payroll taxes that you still pay. That's true. Is it $30K? Is that for married couples? It's $16K for single, yeah. However, you also have to account at that point, though, for your refundable tax credits as well, which I don't know how many. I think the earned income tax credit is refundable. I think the child tax credit is refundable, because theoretically you could end up getting more back from the refundable tax credits than you would from the liability you have on your payroll taxes. I don't know what the chances of that are, though. I guess if you're looking at about 7.5% on average, against 10,000, 750, 20,000 is 1,500, 3,000, is it really that low? Is it $3,000 against $30,000? $1,500 against $30,000 in income. I wonder what the, is there like actually like the average, like the median American earner's tax liability, including payroll taxes or whatever, is that posted anywhere? Does anybody have that? It wouldn't surprise me if it went one way or the other way, depending on how those refundables work. But
and these can be quite burdensome because, unlike income taxes, they start at $1. So it was wrong and misleading in terms of the non-payers. But where it's particularly misleading is when it comes to this top 1%. We see this all the time whenever there are movements to,
like, I don't necessarily maybe disagree with what she's saying, but also, if we're going to criticize one person for not accounting for, you know, all of the nuances of how tax policy works, then, I mean, we should also account for the fact that even if you have a payroll tax liability, you could get most of it back or more than most of it back in the form of a refundable tax credit, depending on your family situation, right?
Impose more taxes on the wealthy. The stories start popping up in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Economist. Those are just in the past couple of months. They all say, what are you talking about? The top 1% are already paying 40% of the income taxes. And what this isn't capturing is that they are talking about, that statistic is referring to the top 1% of income earners, those with the most income, high income, lawyers, doctors, finance people. They indeed are paying a significant chunk of the income taxes. However, when it comes to the wealthiest Americans, the Zuckerberg, Bezos, Musk, Ellison, all the people we hear about so often, they are just as likely to be in the 40% of non-payers as they are in the top 1% of payers. And that's because under our current tax system, they are able to avoid taxes altogether by avoiding taxable income.
I wonder what the average salary is that somebody like Bezos or Elon Musk or Zuckerberg takes from the company. Is it really $0? I feel like it would be some six-figure amount, but I have no idea. I also don't know how much they're liquidating annually on their portfolios either or whatever. I just don't know.
So walk me through this. You're Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Bezos has had an $80K salary for decades. Gotcha.
And taxes. Do you pay? What don't you pay? How do you end up not paying income taxes when
even though a flat tax rate isn't good overall, would it be better than what we currently have? No, because even when taken as a percentage of your income, people that make significantly more money can oftentimes bear a significantly higher percentage tax rate that has less of an impact on them. So the more money you make, probably the higher percentage in taxes even that you should pay, and it'll still affect you less than a lower earner.
You're Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk? Yeah. What are you talking about?
So first of all, let's focus on Jeff Bezos because he's much more of a classic case, right? For Jeff Bezos, he started his own business. He owns, you know, a dominant amount of the stock. And over the course of the years, he has taken a salary that is no higher than $82,000. And it's been over 20 years now, and that's his salary is always capped at $82,000. You might say, well, why would it be? He started the company. He's the man. Why isn't he taking a huge salary to reflect all of the debt he put into the company? And the reason is because salaries are for suckers. When people take a salary, they are subject to high income taxes and payroll taxes, and Jeff Bezos and a lot of our other multi-billionaires have no interest in paying those taxes. So instead, they take their benefits through the growing value of their stock. And
like, I feel like that's kind of true in a business that's made it. Like, salaries are for suckers, because why would you want ordinary income? That's like the fucking worst income. But I mean, how many tech people have been approached with a guy and they're trying to like fucking poach you from Amazon where you're getting like a fucking 300K total compensation. And some guy's like, listen, I've got a sick job for you. I can only afford you 50K, but I can give you some equity up front. And it's like, why the fuck would I want equity in your no-name random shitter startup that's probably going to fail in 2 months after you run out of your dad's cash to, you know, burn through? Like, I mean, she's kind of right. Like, once you've made it, ordinary income is the worst way to be compensated, for sure. But again, it depends, I guess. Yeah.
Their stock has grown enormously. And that massive growth of stock happens entirely tax-free with no time frame under our current system in which that stock will ever be subject to tax. And that is because we only impose a tax if the stock is sold. And Bezos never has to sell the stock because he can simply borrow against the stock and use that money to support his lifestyle and to pay any interest that's due on the loan.
So I want to...
I've heard this, like, the borrow thing over and over again, but I've just never seen compelling, like, analyses or numbers that show that this is, like, a significant thing or problem happening in the U.S. economy. That, like, I think somebody posted a thing a long time ago on the subreddit because somebody was arguing with me and they looked it up. That it's, like, if we were to get rid of this entire tax scheme, we could maybe collect, like, $1 billion more or something in tax revenue. It was, like, it was a relatively insignificant number. I feel like people dramatically overplay this, but...
Slow this down because there's a lot in that answer. Let me start with salaries are for suckers. One thing that, you know, you'll hear is that, no, they're not avoiding a salary. What they're doing is making sure their interests are aligned with the company's. You know, you get a salary kind of no matter what happens in the company, but Bezos only makes money if the stock goes up. So this is public spirited. You know, Elon Musk sometimes making like $1 a year, that these are public spirited CEOs who have yoked themselves to actual success, and we should applaud them for it. That paying themselves in stock is just better for everybody, incentives wise, than salary. Why don't you buy that?
Yeah, because... it's not true. I mean, what is true is that they are profiting through their stock. Arguably, it aligns with the interest, but they could be taking a salary too. It would be deductible to the company. There's nothing that really supports that that's the actual reason for doing so. So, yes, it's a nice cover story, but I don't think anybody presents it with a straight face.
So I think it can sound like we're just picking rich people at random.
Well, I feel like that wasn't a very satisfying answer, no? I don't know what the history is in terms of C-suites and the way that the board looks at compensation for these guys, but the layman understanding I've always heard, the common understanding was that what you don't want is you don't want a CEO to swing by, get a massive, corporate high-level C-suite salary, and then run your company to the fucking ground, and then ditch the company with all the money they've made and potentially some awesome, you know, firing or severance package, and you're fucked. So the idea was, we're going to bring in a C-suite executive. However, your compensation is going to be tied to the value of the company. So you need to make good decisions so that the interest of the CEO or the executive board is aligned with the interest of the shareholders, so that the only way that you guys make money is if we make money. And this is supposed to be aligning the incentives of executives and shareholders. I don't feel like I heard her argue against that, other than saying, well, they could take a bigger salary, which, I mean, I guess they could, but that's not really an argument. I don't know, but okay.
I'm Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk. But there's this 2021 investigation published by ProPublica that came from actual leaked tax documents that gave us a real window into them. We actually know what they paid.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that investigation, what we actually saw and learned from that?
Yeah. So there was a fellow by the name of Charles Littlejohn. That was his actual name.
Named by Dickens.
the Robin Hood character. Yeah. And he was a contractor at the IRS, and he saw all of these tax returns, and he leaked them to ProPublica. He's actually in jail now. He was hit with a very significant prison term when they found him, because there were a lot of very rich, powerful people who were quite angry about
and
this.
It is illegal.
It was absolutely illegal. Right? It was illegal, but the actual penalty was much smaller than what he actually got. And the reason this information was so important is because while tax scholars long knew that there were ways for wealthy people to avoid taxes by avoiding taxable income, right? Taking low salaries and not selling their stock, it was always met with, well, yeah, but you're just, that's just theoretical. That's not real. But here, when these tax returns were leaked, it was no longer theoretical. It was tax returns of many of our richest Americans paying zero in taxes. And so now it's no longer possible for people to say it's just theoretical because it's, we know that it's not.
I mean, that investigation found that year that Warren Buffett had a, what they called a true tax rate of 0.1%, Jeff Bezos 0.98%, Michael Bloomberg 1.3%. I mean,
Doesn't equity just encourage short-term profit chasing over sustainable growth? CEOs don't typically stay around for even a decade. For even a decade at a company, I mean, you can have. Isn't there? I don't know if you'd call it a vesting period for CEOs as well, but like theoretically, you're not supposed to be able to sell your stock for some time. It's like you could come in, do some short-term acquisition thing, triple your stock value, sell it, and leave. Right? Like usually, there's like a period where you have to hold on to it. For at least for employees, it works that way. I feel like for CEOs or for big execs, I feel like it would be the same.
I pay much higher taxes than that.
Yeah. And so I think that, I mean, of course, with
0.1%, Jeff Bezos 0.98%, Michael Bloomberg 1.3%. I mean, I pay much higher taxes than that.
I mean, but you don't know what your taxes are because you're comparing the taxes against their overall wealth versus the taxes that you pay just on your income, which again, these people are far wealthier. And I mean, we might be able to make arguments about capturing that wealth in a form of in some other kind of tax. But you're not comparing apples to apples here. So it's going to sound even more exaggerated than it actually is.
Yeah. And so I think that, I mean, of course, what they're capturing there is their unrealized gains on their stock.
Sure.
Then the next part of the story you're telling, what is the difference between selling stock to fund your lifestyle? Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, they presumably have private planes and multiple homes and fancy vacations and...
Not overall wealth, just wealth appreciation during 1 year. Sure. Okay. But that, I mean, like that's even dumber then, right? Like, I'm sure I could probably dig through Elon's history and find that, oh, my God, like in this year, he actually had a fucking 500,000,000% tax rate because the share value of Tesla dropped so much that his wealth decreased by some huge amount. So he actually had a negative wealth year. And it's just not an apples to apples comparison at all.
What is the difference between funding that by selling stock and funding it by what you just described, which is borrowing against stock?
If they were to sell the stock, then they would have to.
You have complained about the ProPublica method, but you haven't demonstrated why it's bad. If someone is getting a majority of their wealth outside of income, the point is to show how much untaxed wealth is floating. Well, I just told you why it's bad. It's because it's not really capturing. It's just not. It's like a number, but I don't know how interesting or meaningful the number is. So let's say, for instance, let's assume somebody has $2 million in investments. Okay, let's say they have a 401k. Let's say that this person decides that they don't want to work for 2025. And let's say that they just get like a part-time job because they want to talk to people at the gas station. Let's say that this person earns $12,000. Okay, let's say against this $12,000, we'll just say that they pay, I know you have your standard deduction and everything. Let's just say they pay, we'll just keep it nice and simple. This is probably more than they would, but we'll just say they pay $1,000 in tax, okay? Let's say that they pay $1,000 in taxes. Let's say that this $2 million will give it a nice $200,000 appreciation, okay? Let's say that this appreciates $200,000. The ProPublica way of calculating taxes would mean that this person here, okay, they earned $212,000, but they only paid $1,000 in taxes. So their true tax rate was like 0.5%. But like, really? What are we saying that's meaningful here? That's not. I just don't feel like we're making a meaningful statement here. It just doesn't. I don't know. I just don't think we're saying anything of value here. It just doesn't. This is just such a weird way of trying to manufacture the lowest percentage income tax a person could pay to get really mad at it. It just feels like very meaningless to me. I don't like it.
Do two things. One is they would have to pay capital gains taxes, which would be when you take into account all the taxes associated with it, over 23%. So
it's still lower than on a high income.
Absolutely. Selling the stock is definitely a better play than having to take a salary. So
because again, salaries are for suckers.
Because salaries are for suckers. And it turns out selling stock is for suckers too, just slightly less of a sucker. So you get to pay lower tax rates than you would on your, if you were to take a salary. Your payroll taxes are, you don't have payroll taxes. You just have this net investment tax, which is less, and you have a 20% capital gains rate. So that's better than salaries, but not as good as borrowing against the stock. So you go to a private private lender, probably. You know, you could go to a bank, and their biggest risk is that they're going to lend it to somebody who is going to default on the loan. But if you're lending it to Jeff Bezos and he's giving you Amazon stock and other assets to hold as collateral against the loan, the risk of that loan going unpaid is nil. So they are basically making essentially a risk-free loan for which they offer very favorable rates, and still they profit from it because the business is to lend money. But the thing is, when we turn to Bezos' side, the tremendous advantage is that that loan is entirely tax-free. So when he gets that money and buys his yacht, he has not had a taxable event. He continues to own his Amazon stock. He continues to be able to live the lavish lifestyle. And all he has to do is, you know, pay a little bit in interest every year.
I want to stop you again on this. They don't need to pay back the loans because this really doesn't...
Like the amount of money that they're borrowing as a percentage of their total wealth is probably not that high. Would be my guess is like 1% or less, if that. There are simple solutions, I think, that you can kick in here. My favorite one is I feel like you shouldn't be able to take out loans against something that you don't have a tax basis in. So if you have $10 million in assets, if they've appreciated $10 million, then the tax basis for those assets is $10 million, and that's it. You wouldn't have $20 million of assets that you can take out a loan against. If you wanted to take out a $15 million loan against $20 million in assets and only $10 million was you had a tax basis in, then you'd step up the basis $5 million, pay the capital gains on that, and you could take a loan on that. If you really wanted to get around this problem, but like you're not going to raise that much more money, and it doesn't really address any of the huge issues. It's just not – I just don't think that this is like a – people obsess over this thing. I just don't think it's – I just don't think it's that big of a thing. I think people obsess about this.
Feel intuitive?
Yeah.
Like, how is it possible to fund a lavish lifestyle on these loans and no one ever has to pay them back, right? At some point, in theory, the loan comes due.
Well, no. Only you're assuming that Bezos lives in the world of Americans who have like 20-year loans on their homes, and the bank is lending the money, counting on getting the money back. These are people lending money in the business of lending money, and they're happy to keep lending money. Because if you're in the business of lending money and you get the money back, then you have to find somebody else to lend it to. So why not just keep lending it to Bezos?
So you're just taking out, in this way of funding a lifestyle, one loan after
money. Because if you're in the business of lending money and you get the money back, then you have to find somebody else to lend it to. So why not just keep lending it to Bezos?
Well, you can get a higher rate of return depending on what you're lending on. I guess the risk-adjusted rate of return is probably going to be similar across everything, but I mean, money is, you'd lend money to anybody with at higher interest rates, even if it was a risk. I don't understand.
So you're just taking out, in this way of funding a lifestyle, one loan.
What is this woman's background? Hold on. Is she Ray Madoff? Is that? Nope. Not that one. Boston College Law School, where she teaches and writes in tax law and policy, wills and trust law, and estate planning. Okay. I mean, she has some understanding or background in this, at least, I think, yeah.
Loan after another, sometimes paying one loan back with another. And you're just doing this again and again?
So I think what's hard to internalize is how much wealth it really is when somebody has $100 billion, $200 billion, almost $800 billion. But when it comes to somebody like Bezos and our other centibillionaires, their lifestyle is not, they are not bumping up against the value of their entire...
People get compensation packages that add up to basically $900K, but only $150K of that is salary. This isn't just billionaires. If somebody compensates you in stock, is that a taxable event? Or do you just get the stock for free? Holy shit, we got different answers in chat. Let's see. Amazon pays me in stock. Do I have to pay taxes on the stock they pay me, compensate me with? I don't know. What is it? Stock-based compensation, usually restricted stock units, or RSUs. When the stock vests, it's considered taxable income based on the fair market value of the shares that day. Okay, so yes. So I don't think this is relevant at all, but okay.
Your assets, right? A few billion really supports quite a lovely lifestyle, and they don't have to get anywhere near where there's some risk that they can't provide sufficient...
How to tax billionaires. Oh, hold on. You only pay taxes when you sell. No, it's free otherwise. No, I think when they give you the stock, you would pay taxes on the value of the stock when they give it to you. But then if you have the stock, when it's appreciating a value, you wouldn't pay taxes against the appreciation until you sell the stock. Then you would pay taxes against the appreciated value of it. Wouldn't you be paying for it twice then? Well, you would pay, the taxable event would be whenever it's vested to you. And then the second taxable event would be if you sell it after, if it appreciates. But you're not paying, you're not double taxed on it. The first would be the tax that you would pay on the market value of whatever the thing is, and the second would be just on the appreciation after you had it. Somebody said she recommends tax policies in here. You made money last year, you owe tax. Man, this buy, borrow, die thing really hits people's brains a certain way. How much? She wants to get rid of the estate tax and just pass all gains when property's transferred. But isn't that essentially what the estate tax does? There's just a really big write-off as part of the estate tax. You can just get rid of the deduction or whatever, or the whatever the deduction limit is for the estate tax, get rid of the... Okay, well, I don't know. How much money would you even raise doing this? There's like a huge, what is it, like $12 million or something is the standard, is what you can kick off your estate tax or whatever. Like if you leave less than like, or your inheritance taxes, like if you leave less than like $12 million or something to family, they don't have to pay any taxes on it. I feel like it's a huge amount of money. The threshold is huge. Couldn't you just like knock that down? I don't know. That's whatever. Okay. What else do we got? Or what else is she?
Collateral. It would be as if you, in order to support your lifestyle, needed to have $100 relative to the amount of wealth that you have. Do you think it would be hard for you to maintain a loan on that $100 based on the amount of assets that you have and borrow enough to pay to provide sufficient collateral? It would be as if you, in order to support your lifestyle, needed to have $100 relative to the amount of wealth that you have. Do you think it would be hard for you to maintain a loan on that $100 based on the amount of assets that you have and borrow enough to pay the ongoing interest?
So something I don't think it would be hard, but something I think you're getting at here is that consumption doesn't scale. So even we're talking about how do they fund their lavish lifestyles, look, I don't know what Elon Musk's carrying cost is year on year. I don't know how many homes he's got or whatever, but say it's between $25 million and $100 million. Yeah. It's penny change. It's a fraction of the interest.
Yes, that's exactly it. The other thing is that if they sell the stock, they run the risk of giving up control over their companies, and they also run the risk of not being able to enjoy the future growth of their stock. These are companies all heading into the strat.
The vested value is easy to offset in various ways to decrease your effective tax a lot. That's where the tax loopholes actually come in. Okay, Bob the Kid, give us three of them, or give us one of them. What's a way that an average employee can loophole, and don't say 401k or IRA, give a real loophole that doesn't have a minimum or a maximum amount per year in like the thousands.
Sphere, and they don't want to give up any ownership. They want to keep going with this ride, and their stocks have proven to be a very good choice because the growth in value has far outpaced anything they have to pay in interest. So they get to retain control of their companies, they get to ride up the value of these tremendously profitable companies, and they get to do it all entirely tax-free while all the rest of us are left, you know, holding the bag.
All right, so the story you're telling here is a situation where if you have enough money and that money is not seen by the U.S. government as income, you can borrow against that wealth, and that creates a tax-free form of money that you can use, and you just keep rolling it over and rolling it over and rolling it over. I have a couple of questions about this, but before we get into those, I want to compare this maybe to somebody in the 99th percentile. Let's say you're a Beverly Hills surgeon making $2 million a year.
Yeah.
And then let's say you're a tech founder who has $180 million in company stock and only takes a dollar a year in compensation.
Yeah.
Both of those people are rich.
Yeah.
I have a couple of questions about this, but before we get into those, I want to compare this maybe to somebody in the 99th percentile. Let's say you're a Beverly Hills surgeon making $2 million a year.
Yeah.
And then let's say you're a tech founder who has $180 million in company stock and only takes a dollar a year in compensation.
Yeah.
Both of those people are rich.
Yeah.
What is the difference in the way they're taxed?
So the difference is that, and that's a perfect example, the Beverly Hills surgeon is going to pay a lot of taxes, probably in excess of 50% on all of their earnings. So when they have however much they've accumulated over their lives, they've already paid significant taxes on that acquisition of revenue. However, our tech person, who has a mere $180 million, right? Not a billionaire, a piker, still has achieved...
A piker? Was that a... Am I Hassan deranged?
Person who has a mere $180 million, right? Not a billionaire, a piker, still has...
Does that mean something else?
...achieved this $180 million entirely tax-free. There is no tax unless he or she sells the stock. And because they don't have to sell the stock, because they don't want to sell the stock, they often don't sell the stock. And here in the United States, they never have to pay taxes on that gain.
And so then what happens when they pass that stock down? None of us live forever, even though some of us are definitely trying, particularly at the levels of wealth we're talking about here. But
you are assuming they are getting RSUs. Elon Musk getting paid a stock option was going to hold for years without paying taxes. Sure, show me how common that is. I'm just looking at the average compensation. Some guy said average compensation for people that get that work at like Amazon or whatever else. My understanding is most of it is the RSU thing. Give me a percentage or give me an article or something. Don't give me like the, well, actually, there's this one ultra rare thing that Elon Musk or blah, 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 or this vesting or this stock option thing. Give me an article. Link me an article and we can read about it, okay? Jesus.
Assuming they don't figure that out.
Yeah.
You know, the wealthy pass away.
Mm-hmm.
When the very rich today pass away, and this stock or these other forms of assets we might be thinking about get passed down, what happens from the perspective of the tax system?
Theoretically, what's supposed to happen is that the estate tax is supposed to kick in. And its purpose was to address these transfers by gift and at death by imposing a tax at a pretty significant rate.
You said it's not a problem, and I'm telling you every billionaire is doing this. I didn't say it's not a problem. I've already given a couple. I think the step up a basis to borrow against the value of an asset, I feel like that's enough to deal with it, and then we're done with it, okay? So, one, I think there are ways to deal with this if you want to, number one. But number two, I just don't think it's a significant problem. I don't think it's a huge percentage of, there's not like a ton of revenue that we're missing in the United States. Like, fuck, somebody should find that Reddit post. It was like a billion or like maybe in the hundreds of millions of dollars for like U.S. federal tax receipts that we could potentially be missing by not implementing whatever tax schema here we're talking about. Like, it's just not that much that happens here. Even when you're talking about billionaires, you're not talking about that many people in the United States.
In excess of an exemption. Transfers by gift and at death by imposing a tax at a pretty significant rate could happen is that the estate tax is supposed to kick in. And its purpose was to address these transfers by gift and at death by imposing a tax at a pretty significant rate in excess of an exemption amount. Today, that rate is 40% in excess of $15 million. So theoretically, both of our taxes by imposing a tax at a pretty significant rate in excess of an exemption amount. Today, that rate is 40%. In excess of $15 million. So theoretically, both of our taxpayers are going to be subject to some pretty significant tax liability if they have to pay a 40% tax on the transfer of property that's over $15 million. That's how we imagine the system working. The problem is that the estate tax has become so riddled with loopholes that it is really more of a tax in name only than it is an actual burden. And I will give you what I think of as the ultimate evidence of this, which is that the killing the death tax was the number one issue for the Republicans which is what they call the estate tax. Getting rid of the estate tax or killing the death tax was a big issue for the Republicans for at least the past 30 years, right? However, in 2025, when they had the chance to do it, right? So we had President Trump, we had an entirely Republican tax bill, and he could include anything he wanted. All of a sudden, estate tax repeal wasn't there. And why is that? I think it's because the estate tax has become so riddled with loopholes that it serves the wealthy more to keep the estate tax on the books, giving the appearance that the wealthy are paying taxes, than to actually repeal the estate tax, and which would shine a light on all of the ways the income tax system benefits inherited wealth.
Your specialty is states.
Yes.
Tell me about some of the loopholes. If I came to you.
Oh, okay.
Ooh, yeah.
And if I had chosen a more lucrative profession and done well in it, and I come and say, hey, I got $50 million.
Yeah.
And I want to pass it on to my kids, and I don't want the government getting a dime of it. They didn't earn it, and they don't deserve it.
Yeah. So,
what would you in a maybe a more...
What's the difference between this scheme and living entirely off a credit card where you borrow more than you make each year, pay no tax, and then just pay off the interest? Is that one-to-one? Kind of, that would be. But the difference is that if you and I go out and get a credit card, our interest rates are like 26%. And you can't use a credit card technically for everything because you wouldn't be able to like buy major assets with a credit card. Like, you're not going to be able to pay for a car on a credit card. I don't like, normally they let you. Or if you do, they count it as like a cash transfer or a cash advance on the card, which is an even higher interest rate. But if you're going to take a what is it called? Is it like an asset-backed loan or a secured asset loan? You can look these up on Wells Fargo. Your interest rate on that loan is going to track the federal funds rate, prime plus whatever percentage. It'll look like a mortgage rate. So if you're out here trying to live off a credit card, you're paying 26, 27% interest. But if you're out here living off of asset-backed loans, you're paying anywhere from 3 to 7% interest, depending on what the federal funds rate is at the time, right? It's significantly lower. The reality, the hard thing is that, like, there are answers that I can give for why we don't tax capital the same way we tax income, which is true. The answer is technically the person who's earning a W-2 wage is not risking anything of their own. If you get fired, the most you stand to lose is your job, whereas if you're a capital owner, the most you stand to lose is your entire investment, right? Now, that's the textbook answer. The reality is that if you can afford to start a business, you're probably never really that much at risk compared to a W-2 earner who on paper is probably significantly more at risk, right? There's like a paradoxical relationship, I think, with the amount of capital or money available to you. Like, if I were to tell you this person is in debt $50,000, like people get richer the more debt I would give you, right? Like, if I were to say, I know a guy and he's in debt like $500, in your mind, this guy probably works at fast food. How the fuck are you in debt $500? What does that mean? If I tell you a person's in debt like $40,000, $50,000, you're like, oof, this guy's like getting deep. Like, hopefully he's got a job or something or student loans or what. But if I tell you like this guy has $5 million of debt, you're probably thinking like, okay, I guess he's like a business owner or something, or is he making big moves or something, right? Because how does an ordinary person even get access to that much money? The issue is that you can always amplify your wins and minimize your losses the more money that you have. And there's really just no, I don't think there's any way around that ever. Like, that's just reality. Unfortunately, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's fortunate because the more successful you are, the more risk you can take and the more losses you can absorb. But there's never going to be any way to right the ship on that. That's just the reality of literally every single part of life. Think about disease, right? If you are frail and sickly and old and you get sick, you might fucking die. If you're a super healthy young individual, like, you can tank a whole bunch of illness, you know, and still be relatively fine after. It's just, when you're doing better in some area, you're always going to be ready to do more better and more better and more better, and you're always going to be able to absorb losses easier. And sometimes when I hear people talk about, like, billionaire compensation versus an ordinary person, there's literally nothing you can do to bring the risk profiles and the compensation risk profiles or whatever in line with these two people. It's just never going to happen, you know?
Cynical. And
make the case for it's fine for Elon to pay near to no tax on the thing that enabled him to buy Twitter, or am I missing something? At that level, that those transactions are too complicated for me. I don't even know how the fuck all that worked. Because didn't he... To buy Twitter, didn't he take out a loan against his, was it just his net worth, or was it his other business, or I don't even remember how that was structured. But I think it was a relatively high interest loan, though, for that Twitter acquisition, wasn't it? Because, like, I thought that the monthly or yearly payments, I think it was monthly payments he had to make on that loan. Some people were worried in the initial stages of his acquisition that he wouldn't be able to keep up the loan, that it was, like, costing too much or something. But I don't know, it's too much, yeah.
And mercenary version of you.
Yes.
Like the Witcher.
Yeah.
Mercenary version of me here.
Okay, by the cake. This is why I wasn't reading your messages earlier, okay? Because you're typing for way, 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 way more confidence than you deserve to have. For context, the message earlier was like, Destiny, I don't know why you talk about this when you don't fucking know anything about blah, 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 blah. But okay, so you said earlier, well, even ordinary employees can be compensated with taxes, and that's the problem. And I asked you, okay, what are ways that, or, and then I said, but those people have to pay taxes on their stock compensation. And you said, well, that's where the loopholes come in. And then I asked you, what are loopholes like an ordinary person can take advantage of? And the first thing you said, Destiny, one, start your own personal charity, donor advised fund. And if you're really shady, pay your friends to do charity. Okay. Average Amazon worker has their own personal charity that they've started, I guess, for tax purposes. Okay. Two is put it into a trust that you, quote unquote, don't control, but it pays you or people you know for management, charitable remainder trust. Three, other forms of political donations to pay. This is retarded. I love you, buddy, but okay.
Yeah. What would you tell me to do?
Yeah. Well, first,
I'm getting a dime of it. They didn't earn it and they don't deserve it.
Yeah. So
what would you in a maybe a more cynical and mercenary version of you?
Yes.
Like,
I'm doing all of that right now. True.
The Witcher.
Yeah.
Version of me here.
Getting together.
What would you tell me to do?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it would matter here whether you were the surgeon.
And if I
repeal the estate tax, and which would shine a light on all of the ways the income tax system benefits inherited wealth.
Your specialty is estates.
Yes.
Tell me about some of the loopholes. If I came to you, and if I were had chosen a more lucrative profession and done well in it, and I come and say, hey, I got $50 million.
Yeah.
And I want to pass that on to my kids, and I don't want the government getting a dime of it. They didn't earn it and they don't deserve it.
Yeah. So
what would you in a maybe a more cynical and mercenary version of you?
Yes.
Like the Witcher.
Yeah.
Mercenary version of me here.
Getting together.
What would you tell me to do?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it would matter here whether you were the surgeon or the tech entrepreneur with the stock, right? The surgeon has a much harder time because the surgeon has cash. They were paid in cash. They have cash. And it's a lot of
they bought stocks or holding index funds, whatever it might
be. Yes, but most of their wealth was achieved in cash rather than in untaxed appreciation. And so here is where people who own stuff, typically stock, really are able to take advantage of the system in a way that others can't quite as well. If you have a business that's worth, let's say, $100 million and you pass it at death at $100 million, it's valued at $100 million. However, if you cut it up into three minority pieces, 35%, 35%, and 30%, each of those pieces is entitled to a discount of up to like 30, 40%. Now, all of a sudden, your $100 million has been shrunk to $50 million, $60 million, and then it appears on the other side at your kids, blowing back up to $100 million. That's one way we call those minority discounts.
Fuck. I wish I knew more about the underlying tax structures of everything she's talking about. Because it's not, I mean, it's not really the same then, though, right? Because you're transferring, you have to split the asset to three people and divide it differently. Isn't that kind of different? I mean, you could argue, maybe for a death thing, it shouldn't be the same. Like, maybe on death, you shouldn't be able to split an asset and send it to different people that each get preferential or like good tax treatment, maybe, I guess. I don't know. Like, let's say I have a job that I could pay one person to do $100,000 to do, or I could hire two different people to do it at $50,000 each. If I hire two different people to do it, the federal government is technically getting less money than if I hire one person to do it, because the two different people are going to be paying less in taxes than the 100K earner. Right? Is that like cheating? I don't know. Maybe, I guess, I don't know.
But even better, $1 million has been shrunk to $50 million, $60 million, and then it appears on the other side at your kids, blowing back up to $100 million. That's one way we call those minority discounts. But even better are devices where somebody creates a Dynasty Trust. These are really the...
Sounds good. I want the Dynasty Trust.
Exactly. And Dynasty Trusts are fascinating because the purpose of the estate tax was to avoid dynastic wealth, right? And it's a sign of how flagrant the estate planning can be that they actually just call these Dynasty Trusts. Yeah, we know they're supposed to not have dynasties, but we got dynasties for you. And what they do is they create a vehicle for your children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren forever in perpetuity to benefit from this trust and the growing value of this trust. And they get funded through a lot of complex arrangements, oftentimes through sales. You will sell your stock early on to this company in exchange for a low-interest note. And for estate tax purposes, you've gotten it out of your estate. But for income tax purposes, you're treated just as if you're dealing with yourself. So you pay no taxes on that transfer. And these dynasty trusts, through devices like that, are being stuffed with billions and billions and billions of dollars. And this is happening all around the country. Around the country, estate planners are helping their clients fund these dynasty trusts. There's also charitable vehicles that are used, where basically you give a charity an interest up front, and then at the end it goes to a private person, but you price it such that all of the gain is somehow written out of the picture until it magically appears at the end of the story. It's the same thing with grats, rolling grats. A lot of these are stories of...
Oh, yeah, rolling grats.
Rolling grats.
Like of course,
rock,
yeah.
Like rolling rock beer, rolling grats. So a grat is something that is a grantor retained annuity trust, and... you don't want to know what it is, but it is a device by which people are able to transfer enormous amounts of wealth tax-free. And these are just some of the many devices that are used and that estate planners have and have had for too long now.
Why do they have all these devices? Were the devices created to be used this way? Were they created for another purpose and people just figured it out?
Yeah.
Like, is this tax code designed to do this? Or has it been chopped up through kind of brilliant tax machinations?
So...
What do you think about deferable tax of unrealized gains? I don't know about what deferable means. I feel like, I don't know what it would actually play out as, but like some kind of forced 1% of your total like portfolio basis step up every year as like a quasi wealth tax. I feel like I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to something like that. So if you're worth $100 million, but your tax basis for some reason is $0, that like every year there's like a 1% basis step up, that so you have to realize you have to step your basis up in these investments by $1 million. But I feel like I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to something like that. The thing that I don't like about talking about this type of esoteric tax policy is there's a few things. One is it's often cheerled by the most financially retarded people. Two is that this form of tax policy really feels retributive. You're just using it to like attack or punish like billionaires because you hate them, I guess. Three, it puts off conversations about good tax policy. Like what could we do that actually raises a lot of money? Which four is that most of these tax policies that people obsess over wouldn't even raise that much revenue. So I don't know what the purpose, the purpose is because of the other things I said. It's just people that want to attract the billionaire class, but they're not even big revenue raisers. So I don't know. That's my big frustration with them usually.
Let me step back for a second. In order for a tax system to work, there has to be a dance between taxpayers and Congress or the IRS, whoever is the regulating authority. Basically, Congress sets out some rules, the IRS sets out some regulations, taxpayers and their estate planners or other advisors find ways around the rules. Congress or the IRS is supposed to come back in here and close the loopholes, respond to that, taxpayers go out, they try to find other loopholes, and together there's this dance that it does a pretty good job of making sure that the tax system is doing a pretty good job of collecting the revenue we need in the country to run the country. For much of the 20th century, this worked pretty well with the estate tax. The estate tax was seen as a very innocuous tax, well accepted in the country. It serves as a backstop to the income tax system, which had all these ways for wealth to grow tax-free, right? And the estate tax was there as like a sweep-up tax to make sure that it was going to be subject to tax. The problem was, in 1990, they stopped. And that was the last time we have had any reform done to the estate tax. But of course, the estate planners haven't stopped.
Did it stop? Because my understanding is we've had cuts to it since then.
I mean, exactly.
George W. Bush, you could call it reform or not reform, but it has been chopped up and sliced up and made weaker.
All that, right.
So quite a bit since then.
Well, what has happened is that there have been two changes. The exemption amount has increased and the rates have decreased.
And so there was a big discourse around this. I remember this a bit. You know, it's like, oh, these people are passing down family farms and their family farms are getting taxed away.
Yes.
And so they cut it up then. So how does it change?
Right. So that double tax that hurts family farms and businesses, the death tax, that campaign was funded by 18 of the country's wealthiest families in the early 1990s. So the Mars, the Kochs, the Waltons, they all got together and they were like, okay, we got the income tax handled, right? We can borrow, we can avoid salaries, but this estate tax, Congress keeps fixing it. They keep doing the generation skipping transfer tax. They do the special valuation rules. We got to stop them. And they funded this campaign to turn the public against the estate tax. And they did so by telling the public that the estate tax was an immoral death tax, making it seem like it came for everyone, right? Rather than the estate tax, which definitely had a sort of a rich people heir to it. So they said, no, this is a death tax. It comes for all. And it particularly harms family farms and businesses. Now, what they didn't say was that there are actually a lot of provisions in the tax code specifically designed to protect family farms and businesses. And indeed, Congress had a very hard time finding actual examples of people who actually lost their farms. Their favorite person who they used was this fellow by the name of Chester Thigpen, who had a farm.
What a name.
Yes. And he was the grandchild of slaves. And he testified in Congress that he was afraid he was going to lose his farm due to the death taxes that were going to be imposed when he died. And he was so effective that Republicans wanted to call it the Chester Thigpen Estate Tax Repeal Act because he was such a compelling figure. Well, a few years later, Chester Thigpen dies. And turns out he wasn't subject to the estate tax at all because, in fact, his farm fell well within the exemption and there are other areas to protect it. So they Congress could have easily addressed the family farms and business a problem, if one sees that as a problem, by basically expanding the protections that were already there. But instead, they were using it as a cover for all of the people, the Mars, the Waltons, all of those people that had massive amounts of inherited wealth, and they wanted to be able to pass it tax-free.
Okay, so I found these numbers in your book kind of shocking. In 2000, before the Bush tax cuts, Americans filed 122,000 estate tax returns. In 2010, it was 47,000. In 2013, after Obama's tax plan went into effect, it was 32,300. Then after Trump, there were 6,158 in 2021, of which only 2,584 were actually taxable. So either between 2000 and 2021, rich people stopped dying, or they stopped being rich people, or we really gutted this thing within an inch of its life.
Yeah. I'm going with number three. So in 2024, the richest 1% of Americans controlled massive amounts of the country's wealth, $50 trillion. And yet the estate tax that was designed to apply to all transfers at death and by gift, and there's a lot of gifting that goes on because, as I mentioned, those techniques all involve gifting. So lots and lots of gifting is going on by these people. The 40% estate tax only raised $30 billion in 2024. Out of $50 trillion wealth owned by the richest 1% of Americans. It is practically nothing. It is an amount that Elon Musk has both earned and lost in just a single day and probably hardly even noticed. So clearly, the estate tax is not doing what we think it's doing.
This will sound stupid, but I think it's worth talking about. Why are there different rates for different kinds of income? Why do we treat income earned at our job, income earned by selling stock, and income earned when somebody dies and leaves everything to us, or income given to us as a gift? Why do we treat them all differently? What are we trying in theory?
Right.
To achieve.
It's interesting. Andrew Mellon, who was known as a tremendous anti-tax crusader, felt that...
Famed robber baron.
Yes. Felt that this... And also Secretary of the Treasury and a number of administrations, felt that the rules should be that income is taxed at the lowest rates and investments are taxed at the highest rates. Because people earning income, they are in the most precarious situation and they are likely to need the lower rates as opposed to people who are just sitting back and relying on their investments.
Let me read the quote here. I took this down. It's in your book. This is from Andrew Mellon's 1924 book, Taxation, The People's Business. He writes, "The fairness of taxing more lightly income from..."
This is generally true. This is why the textbook answer for why people that own capital don't pay the same rates as ordinary income earners because they have to risk their capital to earn the money is, it's like technically true, but it's like not in practice, not really. Like if you're the kind of person that can have a business and do investments, you're probably better off financially. So you're not really in some precarious position where if the business that you started goes under, you're now a complete and total brokey or something.
Wages, salaries, or from investments is beyond question. In the first case, the income is uncertain and limited in duration. Sickness or death destroys it, and old age diminishes it. Here he's talking about wages. In the other, the source of income continues. The income may be disposed of during a man's life, and it descends to his heirs. That Andrew Mellon is saying that it was beyond question that you should tax wage income more lightly than investment income. I mean, it speaks to a very different time. So what is the thinking that leads us into the current world, where no matter how you think about the code, it is the reverse. Income, if I sell stock, that gets taxed more lightly than the income from that, than the income I make from the New York Times.
Yeah. And what
you are under a lot more risk due to fiduciary, et cetera, regulations and rules. Like if you fail at the company, you can get sued for losing shareholders' money. Oh, okay. Thank you, Metalloid Sword. True. Actually, you're right. I think I would just rather be an employee than a successful business owner. True. Thank you. Thank you for giving me that one. Thank you. True. Thank you.
What's interesting is when you actually dive into it, there are 50 reasons of arguments that are given about why investment gains should be taxed at a lower rate. Things like, well, sometimes you might be, there might be a lot of inflation if a lot of time has passed, so maybe it's not actual gains. And some say it's good to encourage investments. And others say, and I find this the ultimate in distorted reasoning, they say, look, right now, people are encouraged not to sell their stock because they can avoid tax by not selling. We have to lower the rates in order to lure them into selling. And so that is another justification, even though they should just tax the gains and then people would sell.
It's also the word he uses here I think is interesting, fairness. Yeah. I've been around this debate a long time. I've covered a lot of tax debates. I've covered debates on the capital gains tax rate. Get into a lot of arguments about efficiency and, you know, the exactly right macroeconomic level to turn the dial to. And yet, as a human being, right, just experiencing the way income works, I work so hard for the income I make from my work. I mean, you're a delivery driver, you're, you know, a doctor doing primary care work or a pediatrician. Right. You're working so hard. And the idea that that is taxed so much more higher than somebody making money by just letting money sit in an index fund.
Right.
Or just occasionally clicking a button to move it between, right, you know, different investments. There is a fairness question here. It's cruel. I also think it's like actually quite cruel. It is so easy to let your money make money for you. The fact that we reward it over work is crazy to me.
I totally agree. And you know who else agreed? Ronald Reagan. In the 86 Tax Act, they actually succeeded in equalizing for a very brief period. I mean,
you could frame that other ways if you wanted to, right? I do agree in principle. Obviously, emotionally, it feels bad. But imagine you do want to start a business, or imagine that you do want to buy a car and you have to go borrow money for it. Like, why the fuck should anybody give you money for anything if you don't have the money already? Well, you have to borrow it from somebody. And if you're going to borrow it from somebody, you have to compensate them for the risk that they're getting on the loan or the investment. So, I mean, like, you do want it in society. You do want a society where people are making investments or lending money. Like, it is, at the end of the day, it does benefit all of us, right?
Capital gains rates and ordinary income rates. They got rid of the preference for capital gains, which we should definitely do today. Now, one of the arguments that someone's going to make is, yes, but every...
What's she going to say? Double tax argument?
Everybody is better off when rich people take their money and they invest in the economy.
Oh.
That's what makes the whole country grow. But the thing is, much of this money is, this is not seed capital to start local businesses. This is money trading on a secondary stock market. It is not going to a business. It's going to other owners of stocks driving up the shares.
I don't know what that means. I don't even know what she means by that.
On a secondary stock market. It is not going to a business. It's going to other owners of stocks driving up the shares.
Is she saying the majority of wealth is in like derivative markets or what? I don't understand what she means by that.
So I don't buy that argument that this is, you know, this is growing the economy when people are putting their money in stocks.
Well, let me ask about a related...
I feel like we needed way, 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 way more of an explanation there, but okay.
...the dimension of this, which is the rise of stock buybacks.
Yeah.
And what, both how that has changed the way stocks work,
mm-hmm,
and how that has changed the way taxable income,
yeah,
presents or does not present itself.
We've been telling a story about wealthy people not paying taxes on their stock because their stock goes up in value. They don't have to pay tax on that gain. However, prior to 1982, because companies could only share their profits through dividends, what it meant to own a lot of stock was to get a lot of dividends. And for much of the 20th century, dividends were taxed at the highest rates, just like salaries. And so what that meant was that somebody who was sitting on a lot of stocks got a lot of dividends and paid a lot of taxes. However, in 1982, after this rule change, companies switched from issuing dividends. It used to be more than 70% of profits were distributed through dividends. Now it has never been as high as 20% since this change went into being. The effect of it is that companies began to do lots and lots of buybacks of their stock. And this had a tremendous impact on multiple levels. One is, if you look at the Dow Jones, there's a chart in my book that shows that in 1982, the Dow Jones was at about 3,000. It was also that in the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, the 40s, the 30s, and the 20s, it was around 3,000, its inflation-adjusted amount. Now it's like in the 45,000, something like that today, right? So it switched from being a sine curve to being a hockey stick. And part of this story is stock buybacks, because stock buybacks boost the value of stock. But another important part of the story is that it meant that for somebody who owned stock, they no longer had to get taxable income, because they could enjoy their profits through the increased value of the stock. Some shareholders would sell their stock because that's the nature of the stock buyback. However, a lot of these shareholders are tax-exempt organizations, so they're not worrying about paying taxes on their proceeds. So in terms of revenue to the federal government, owning stock, profitable companies used to provide a lot of revenue to the federal government in the form of taxation of dividends. And now with the rise of stock buybacks, that is much less likely to be the case.
So then I want to go back to the question of what happens to these...
Like, if she's writing articles and everything on all this, it'd be nice to get more numbers here, I think, but okay.
...fortunes when they get passed down. How is that treated for you from a taxation perspective? Like, when does that get taxed?
Okay, so if you receive it at death, then there is an extra benefit for people who receive appreciated property at death. And that is that not only are those gains not taxed to the person who held the stock, but when somebody receives the stock from inheritance, all the gains are wiped away. We call this step up in basis. Or
fuck me, dude. It's been so long since I've read on this. Can't you only eliminate the step up in basis gains based on whatever the exemption is for the estate tax? So like if you get $1 million of stuff that's appreciated by $900,000, because it's under the $15 million exemption or whatever, you can step the basis up using the exemption. Isn't that how that works?
Or the...
A nice inscrutable name.
Yes. Or the Angel of Death loophole.
That's
yes. And the Angel of Death loophole says that we're going to wash away the gains and the recipient is going to be treated as if they had purchased the property.
Okay, I want to slow this down for a minute because I think step up basis here is really, really quite important. Let's say somebody made just great investment. They bought NVIDIA when it was cheap. And you know, now some years later, they have $30 million worth of it. In one world, they... really, really quite important. Let's say somebody made just great investment. They bought NVIDIA when it was cheap. And, you know, now some years later, they have $30 million worth of it. In one world, they sell that stock because, you know, they want to buy a mansion or whatever it might be. In another world, they never sell the stock. They pass away.
Wait. New Bulwark video just dropped for members, and it's Sarah Longwell and JVL, who is pretty ruthless. On Israel, JVL says, if for no other reason that Bibi deliberately rat-fucked Democrats and Biden to help Trump in 2024, the next Democratic president should politically slap Bibi around publicly and privately. Thoughts on that? I think that there should be a massive accounting for Israel and Israeli leadership, of course. I mean, like, our political destiny, to some extent, just because of our close relationship with them, is are pretty tied together. They're pretty intertwined. And Israel can't continue to function like a country that has no friends and, like, it's not tearing down the reputation of people around it. I think that it's totally fair to get into some big accountability things related to Israeli leadership and some of the more unhinged people in that country.
Give all of their kids. Years later, they have $30 million worth of it. In one world, they sell that stock because, you know, they want to buy a mansion or whatever it might be. In another world, they never sell the stock. They pass away and give it all to their kids.
Yeah.
What is the difference in tax treatment for that stock? It is the same tranche of stock.
Yes.
What happens in the two scenarios?
So in the first scenario, they would pay income taxes on this, on the capital gains. The capital gains is imposed at a 20% rate plus an additional 3.5% extra tax on it. So almost a quarter of it, of those gains, and it's almost all gains, would be subject to income tax.
And so the gains are the difference between what you bought it at and what you sold it at.
Absolutely. However, if instead you on this, on the capital gain, yes.
What happens in the two scenarios?
So in the first scenario, they would pay income taxes on this, on the capital gains. The capital gains is imposed at a 20% rate plus an additional 3.5% extra tax on it. So almost a quarter of it, of those gains, and it's almost all gains, would be subject to income tax.
Okay. And so the gains are the difference between what you bought it at and what you sold it at.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. However, if instead you hold on to that stock and you don't sell it and you pass it on at death to your kids, there is an extra bonus. And that is that not only did you not pay taxes on that gain, but when they get the property, they are treated as if they had purchased it for its fair market value. And so now they're treated as if they had bought it for $30 million. And so they can turn around and sell it for $30 million and pay no gains at all. And that is this thing that we call step up in basis, or the Angel of Death loophole.
So the gains are just wiped away.
Wiped away. Not for you to worry about.
That's pretty sweet.
Yes. It's a very nice deal.
So what do you expect will happen with a Jeff Bezos then? Can he pass down $150 billion or whatever it is without too much tax implication?
Well, it's going to matter about $150. It seems like a lot of money. Chances are what these people are going to use are charitable vehicles as an important part of their tax-free transfers. And the problem is that these charitable vehicles...
Step up in basis, erasing all capital gains accrued with a step up. Yeah, but I thought you could only step the basis up as much as the estate tax exemption would allow you to. Like, it's whatever you can, you basically are eating through the estate tax exemption to step up the basis. I thought is how it worked. So it's not an unlimited amount. It's the $15 million whatever amount, which you could still, I guess, argue is not good, but.
Afford these donors and their families enormous tax benefits while continuing to give them enormous power in the world. And some of these vehicles, some of these tax avoidance vehicles, if they set them up during life, are not just for charity, but are to influence politics. And that's because you can put money into a 501c4, that's a particular type of organization that is allowed to engage in political activity. And under our current rules, when you give your appreciated stock, let's say somebody decides to give $50 billion to their C4, they get to have continued control over the assets and a tax-free path to avoid both gift taxes and capital gains taxes.
So let's talk about what you might do about some of this. I think something people are hearing a lot about right now is a wealth tax. Mm-hmm. One reason they're hearing about it is that there is a wealth tax on the ballot in California this year, a one-time 5% wealth tax.
Jesus.
These operate a little bit differently for states and for the federal government. So let's begin with the one in the news, which is the California one. How would it work? What do you think of it? What are the considerations for a state thinking about doing this?
The wealth tax is an obvious answer to this problem. It says, all right, we have a lot of ways that people are avoiding taxable income and they have massive amounts of wealth. Let's tax their wealth. and we'll impose a flat tax, 5%. The problem for states is sort of a few problems, but one of them is that people can easily leave states. Now, California is trying to get around this problem of people leaving the state by making it this sort of retroactive one-time tax. It already applies retroactively to people who previously were living in the state, I think, as of January 1st. A retroactive one-time tax, I think, is it's not going to be a permanent solution to the problem, obviously. And nor do I think it's going to prevent people from leaving the state, because once there's a done once, there's every reason to expect it will be done again. So I do think there is a problem for states in their ability to raise revenue because other states are trying to compete on these low taxes.
So you have in that case is something like Ron DeSantis in Florida.
Absolutely.
Trying to attract. I met a rich person not long ago who showed me an app they have that counts the number of days they spend in Florida because they really want to live in New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they live in Florida. I mean, they actually do live in Florida,
right.
Just enough days a year to not pay New York taxes, which I found crazy because I figured the whole point of being rich was to not have to worry about things like this.
You know, I think this is
but
why
people really do it, I guess.
Yes, I think I find it insane to be rich and to have to live somewhere that you don't want to live. But of course, this is why you're a podcaster and I'm a law professor, right? If we really cared about money, maybe we'd really care about taxes. And because to me, it seems insane, but people do that all the time.
So do you think
I love that I'm part of you guys now. Keep that in mind. Don't ever forget it, okay? We're the same, you and me, okay? We have the same lived experiences. We're not like those billionaires, guys. Not you and me. You and me, we're the same, okay? You might spend $1,000 on an emergency car repair. I might spend $1 million on a frivolous lawsuit. But at the end of the day, you and me, we're the same, guys. We're not billionaires. Just remember that, okay? We're not billionaires. If we really cared about money, guys, we'd be like them. But we're not like them, okay?
The wealth tax proposal be good for California, or is it something that, you know, would just create a benefit for Texas because it'll pull in these rich people?
Well, it's hard to say that it's going to make a huge difference when it's just a one-time tax. So it would have to actually be a more permanent tax. And I think it has a number of problems. One of them is the problem of people leaving. But I think another really significant problem is how you're going to gather the information of how much wealth a person has. It's very easy to think about somebody who owns publicly traded stock, and we know how much stock they own, and we know how much they have. But there are lots and lots of wealthy people that own their wealth in other forms that are very difficult to value. And now you're talking about a state Department of Revenue having to build up the resources to have everybody tell them everything they own and keep up with valuation of it. It's going to be quite
How much is your art collection worth?
Exactly.
How much are your crypto NFTs worth?
Absolutely. And if also, when you start to look at things like partnership interests, these are highly complex structures, and it's impossible for somebody to be able to monitor that for all of the different taxpayers. So it's a very, very difficult, practical task to get around. Now, again, California has some solution where you can defer paying taxes and all of these things, but it's just very difficult to do. It's not as easy as it sounds. And I think that it's also a problem in terms of winning the support of the American public, because we pay taxes on the value of our homes. But generally, when we think of the value of all of our assets, we know that there's an estate tax at death. But that's very different than requiring people to disclose every single thing they own during their lives every year. That, I think, is going to feel invasive to the public, not just to the people who are subject to the rules, but to the other people who are thinking about the fairness of these rules.
But that question also applies to a federal wealth tax, which maybe brings us to that. So, you know, I think to the extent these proposals are associated with anybody, it's by Elizabeth Warren, who's had a number of them over the years. But there are proposals for different forms of national wealth tax, you know, something like it would be 2 percentage points of your wealth every year, year on year. And how do you think about this?
Yeah. So in the federal level, you get to avoid the problem, I think, of people moving. Sometimes people say, oh, no, people are going to leave the United States. It's very hard to leave the tax clutches of the United States. And also, this is not an age in which people, a lot of people want to regularly give up their U.S. citizenship, right? This is and become a citizen in some other country.
Dubai or whatever.
Exactly. I don't think people claim that.
I think looks bad at the moment.
Yes, exactly.
The Dubai move, which people in the U.K., the rich in the U.K. sometimes do, and I think has been called into question by the recent war.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that's something that people threaten will happen. I don't think that would happen here. But the bigger problem here is the constitutional issue. So our federal constitution basically has these special rules about direct taxes and indirect taxes, and wealth taxes raise constitutional issues. It's hard because we have a limitation in our constitution on direct taxes. And the problem is that given our current Supreme Court, we have every reason to think that this Supreme Court might find a wealth tax unconstitutional, which it could very easily not survive. So all of that political effort will have been spent for nothing. And it just seems like not a smart way to go, particularly in today's world where the wealthy are able to avoid taxes so easily through the sort of highway of alternatives of tax avoidance because of our failure to tax their investment gains and their inheritances. So I think there's a lot more easier paths to follow. It's not going to be as immediately effective as a wealth tax, but it's...
I think all of these things, I say this a lot, this is why I feel like I don't like this tax conversation on this. When you look at taxes, I feel like they're trying to solve for these social problems through tax code, which is not appropriate. I think the issue with taxes is that we should be looking at the programs that we want to fund and then we should look at how much money we want to raise, and we should look at the fairest way to raise that money. I think these are the only things that you should think about when it comes to tax policy. I think that there is an issue right now where capital today is just so ungodly powerful, and the tendrils of capital can spread so far. Like, what is the strongest form of capital you could have 1,000 years ago? I don't know, like a ship, or maybe a few ships, or maybe a company of ships, I guess. What else? Like, I don't know, what else, right? Is besides, like, I guess, like transportation stuff. Whereas today, like, you can have a business that, you know, it has millions of employees and has it's everybody on the entire planet can invest in it, and it can grow so massively, vertically, horizontally. It can encompass other industries. It can outcrowd a market. You can make so many sales to every single individual on the planet. I think capital is just so much more powerful than it used to be, and it's hard to address, I think, like, the disproportionate power of capital with just, like, tax policy. I don't know.
More likely to be permanently effective.
So then what would you do?
Yeah. So what I think should happen is, first of all, we have to look at investment gains. And the problem with our investment gains is that they are never taxed to the person who owns it, unless they sell the property. However, in Canada, they have a much broader rule. And that rule is that whenever the person transfers the property, not just by sale, but also by gift or at death, the gains at that time will be tallied and the person will have to pay tax on that gain. And that way, gains are taxed to the person who earned them rather than kicking it down the road to some.
Yeah. I feel like that's a no-brainer. If you transfer something to somebody, the basis should be stepped up. Yeah, that should count. That should count as a taxable event. I would agree with that 100%.
Time in the future that may never come. I personally would, if I could write the rules, I would say that we should eliminate the distinction between capital gains and ordinary income and give them an inflation adjustment to reflect that inflation holding. And other than that,
I feel like that would be a dramatic increase in capital gains taxes, because their top rate is like 20%, whereas for income, is it 39? I don't know what the highest marginal bracket is. But I think you could step up the capital gains rate like 5 or 10 points, maybe. I think that would be okay.
Impose ordinary income rates on that gain. In addition, we need to address inheritances. So people are receiving massive amounts of wealth entirely tax-free. If you were to walk down the street and find $100, you would be expected to report that to the federal government. However, if someone were to give you $100 billion, you literally don't have to tell anyone. There's not even a line on your tax return to let anyone know, because that is seen as entirely your business. And we should not have to report entirely tax-free. If you were to walk down the street, people are receiving massive amounts of wealth entirely tax-free. If you were to walk down the street and find $100, you would be expected to report that to the federal government. However, if someone were to give you $100 billion, you literally don't have to tell anyone. There's not even a line on your tax return to let anyone know, because that is seen as entirely your business. And we should not have that be the case. We should get rid of the estate tax, which isn't doing anything.
That's true. You could just hand somebody $100 billion.
Wait, I don't understand what she means by that. Is she talking about through, like, trust vehicles or something? Or
then you don't have to report it to anybody?
The person who hands it is supposed to report a gift tax return, right? But if it's been put into a trust, the trust has grown, it's distributed.
Okay, well, that's more complicated. Come on.
From the trust, the person receiving the property may have some flow-through gains through complicated tax rules, right? But the receipt of property by gift, inheritance, or life insurance. And by the way, life insurance is the favorite vehicle of the super wealthy to pass their wealth when they convert it into a life insurance policy.
Sort of. I think wealth used to be more powerful, like robber barons owned company towns and a private army of Pinkertons, which sounds like pretty scary private power. I mean, you say that, but I think wealth is more powerful today. There's just more government restrictions in liberal societies on what you could do with that wealth. Like, if we were to legalize private armies and stuff, I think Bezos and Elon and all these guys would have the money to fund a private army. They just don't, because we just live in a better society today, right?
See, it all of a sudden becomes non-taxable everywhere. That is received. Those are subject to exclusions, meaning you don't have to even report them.
You know, one thing that the way you just described that, I think, makes clear is that there's a level of tax design, and then there's the level of the will to enforce tax design, which is to say that if you imagine the kind of reform you're talking about, you can make it, but then you would have to actually want it to work, such that you began shutting all this other stuff down and keeping it shut down, right? Like these life insurance loopholes you're talking about. But how do you think about these two levels, right? There's a level of tax design, and then the level of the tax code is complex. People don't know what's happening in it. But the people who do know what's happening in it have a very, very, very strong incentive to support politicians who will allow them to keep using these loopholes, or to punish politicians who try to close them.
I think the feeling that you're locked out of any proportional / fair amount of power because of what influential capital is and the way it compounds is the thing people are sublimating into this hatred for billionaires thing. Given the compounding, how do you push a reset button on that? Historically, this has been global conflict or something. Is there a way to expand our notion of monopoly and antitrust or something? Well, the thing is that, like, our perceptions of everything are so fucked up now too. Like, I do agree that it's really stupid. Dude, El Sayed guy or whatever gave like the perfect brain rot take on this. It just triggered the ever-loving fuck out of me. fuck, how long ago was this? This is a good tweet, okay? This should have had more engagement than this one, all right? In before, oh.
Donald Trump has this one knee trick. He will blame every problem you have on an immigrant. You're out of a job, immigrant took your job.
True.
Out of healthcare, immigrant took your healthcare. True. Out of housing, immigrants living in a house you should have.
Wait, not true that that's true, but Donald Trump will blame immigrants for everything, yes.
Been able to afford. We have a...
Like, that's true. They Republicans like simple problems for complex things. Liberals have complained about this for a long time. They could have easy answers for everything. It's like, okay, true. Okay, this is bullshit. We acknowledge this is bullshit, right?
Far better set of answers.
Okay.
Which is, if you're out of a job, it's probably because a corporation figured out how to offshore or automate your job. I mean, think about AI.
Oh.
Like, that's been the entire business model. It's okay. Automate all of the jobs.
Evil corporations.
If you're out of a home, it's probably because a corporation is speculating on the home that you probably should have been able to afford. If you're out of healthcare, it's because a corporation is definitely figuring out how to monetize you because you get sick.
Like, this dance from brain rot position to brain rot position, and people, like, this is all just different forms of populism where you just, like, identify some fucking enemy that's destroying everything in your life, and the simple answer is to get rid of all the enemies. It's just, like, it's so brain rotty.
Yeah. So... let me start by confessing I am an optimist by nature. So you may need to take everything I say with a grain of salt. However, I think that this system of non-payment by wealthy Americans came about because of our particular history and particular vulnerabilities of the estate tax. So we had a system where the income tax was incomplete. The estate tax was supposed to be a backup. The assault on the estate tax in the early 1990s was so effective that even Democrats were afraid to do anything to close the loopholes because so many Americans saw it as an unfair double death tax. I think if we had a cleaner system that we could easily have, we get rid of the estate tax, we have an income tax system, it gets a lot harder to pull the wool over the eyes of the public. So I don't think it's the case that rich people can always control, always get what they want. I think that we are living in a moment now where this is, there's more pressure than ever for this to happen. This California wealth tax, right, this is happening because the public has become broadly aware that we've got a lot of super rich people that control massive amounts of the country's wealth, more than they've held, I think, since the 1920s. Significant amounts. I think it's currently 31.7%, 32% of the country's wealth is held by the richest 1% of Americans. And at the same time, none of them seem to be wrapping themselves in glory these days, right? If we go back 20 years, we had all sorts of amazing things being done by our rich people.
True.
And there was a book that came out in the early 2000s that was called Philanthrocapitalism. And the subtitle was How the Rich Can Save the World, right? And this was not seen as insane. Can you imagine a book today, How the Rich Can Save the World?
Ray, I'm in the professional painting business. I can imagine anything.
Yeah. But the idea that someone would think that this would land with the public, which it did in that era, right? The super rich, they can do so many things. We should hand over all of society's problems to them. I mean, I think a lot of people would find that laughable today.
I think something that comment is getting at is sometimes people want to tax the rich because they want to punish them. They just, like, they don't like the rich. They definitely don't like the rich right now, right? I'm very sympathetic to the argument you're making. And on the other hand, that then sort of winds a lot of things up in moral judgment. When sort of my view is that Sergey Brin should have to pay taxes on that wealth, no matter if he's in the don't be evil era or in the
evil era. I completely agree. I think it is a big mistake to focus on rich people are bad and therefore we should be imposing taxes, because the reason I think it's bad is because when we move the conversation to whether rich people are good or bad, we are not focusing on the fact that the richest Americans have been written out of our tax system. It's as if we had a system that said people who live in Pennsylvania don't have to pay tax. Right? We shouldn't have a discussion that says, well, some of the people in Pennsylvania are good. Maybe it's okay they don't pay tax, right? It's wrong as a matter of principle. It's wrong because we need their money. It's wrong as a matter of fairness. It is wrong for so many reasons. And I think the big problem, it goes back to your earlier question, which is that the public is misled into thinking the wealthy are paying more taxes than they are. And that is why, that with this 1% paying 40%, right? Most of the public doesn't know that the wealthiest Americans are able to avoid taxes by paying taxable income. And if they knew, they wouldn't want that system.
I find what you're telling me here to both track what people I know who have worked on crafting wealth taxes tell me, but I find very frustrating, which is that it seems like it should be possible. And the more you get into it, the harder it becomes, both constitutionally, which is one dimension of it, but the valuing and the continuous valuing and the worrying about people moving things into harder to value assets becomes a problem. And I don't know, I've wanted there to be a wealth tax as long as I've been aware of taxation. And the thing that I feel we're losing if we can't do something like it, which I just think is worth naming, is that wealth creates power. It creates a tremendous amount of power. And we're operating in this era when it's not that the rich were necessarily, the super rich, so shy about using their wealth to wield power. I mean, you mentioned the anti-estate tax campaign that was heavily funded by 18 of the richest families. But the level of, like, direct engagement that you're seeing now from people like Elon Musk,
yeah,
like, they are really making the long-running fear that if you have enormous wealth, concentrations of wealth, you'll have, like, unmanageable concentrations of political power manifest. And you can design a tax code, you know, that taxes this money eventually. But it doesn't solve the political power question in a way that I think a lot of people want to use a tax code to do so. And I'm curious how you think about that.
Yeah, I think it's a real problem and it's a real concern. I mean, people controlling massive amounts of wealth have tremendous power in our society. And I understand that in some fantasy world, a powerful enough wealth tax will be enacted to make a sufficient enough dent in the wealth of the wealthiest people where it is brought down to a level where they no longer have this power. However, from where I sit, that just looks like a fantasy world. That's not going to happen. It's not going to be significant enough. The public isn't going to buy it generally. And I think one of the reasons the public isn't going to buy it generally is because of something we talked about earlier, which is that to the extent it is a special tax focused on the richest people, like we have to punish the richest people, I don't think everybody in the country agrees with that. A lot of people in the country think that people who have acquired their wealth have done so because they've done great things. They've started great companies, and sometimes they have. Sometimes they have done great things. And so it paints too broad a brush. The problem with it is that we have to live in the world that we actually live in. And in the world we actually live in, I don't see that as being a solution that's going to deliver that result.
I think there's also another dimension to why you should want to make sure the richest people are paying taxes. And that is that people do what other people do.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this while reading your book and preparing for this. I pay taxes. I don't mind paying taxes. I think that is part of living in a society. Living in America has been good to me. It does piss me off that people above me are not paying taxes.
Yeah.
And what I hear sometimes, I'm talking about their weird strategies, and I'm not talking about centibillionaires here, just you know, people who spend more time on tax avoidance. You think, am I being a sucker?
Yeah.
And the fact that at these very high levels, the very richest are making the rich people right underneath them feel like suckers. People don't want to be suckers. They don't want to feel that other people are getting a deal they're not getting. Now, on one hand, you might think it would be good if this made more rich people, you know, advocate for a better tax system, which it doesn't seem to have done, to shut down the ability of people above them to do this. But I do think that it's very corrosive to social solidarity.
I completely
agree. To have the sense that there are people out there getting a way better deal than you are.
I couldn't agree more. And that's why I think a lot of that has to...
I think it's worth addressing kind of, but like, that's always just going to be the case. Somebody who's in a better position than you is always going to be getting one over you in some way, and in every, you're never going to be able to balance all this out. Not to say that you should say fuck it and not do anything about it, but I don't know how much the feeling tracks the reality for that.
Do with the fact that people feel like this point that you made before, well, the regular people are always going to lose out. The rich are always going to have their way. It's always going to be to their advantage. But that is not always the case. And that's why I think it's important to think back in history to different times. So one of the times I think is particularly interesting is the Tax Reform Act of 1986. That is the last time that we actually have had any really meaningful reform in the tax system. It was under President Reagan, which was kind of surprising, but it adopted principles of a lot of from that had been around under both parties. And what it did, when we talk about high-income earners and the inability of high-income earners to avoid taxes, that is because of changes that occurred.
Ever since you came into wealth, would you say your mind was blown with how many cool tax strategies you were given by your CPA? Not really. There's not much I can do because most of my shit is just in earnings 1099 shit for my business. So unfortunately, no. There are like some things you can do, like you can lost harvest on investments and shit if you buy individual stocks instead of just index fund shit, or you can... once you own a business, you can expand your 401k personal options to yourself. And I don't know if backdoor routes are still a thing or if backdoor routes got killed, but it's not that much. Not really. Once you start owning like big, like a C Corp, or once you start dealing with like property, like real estate, I think you can do a lot more crazy shit, but.
In 1986. Prior to 1986, we had a flourishing tax shelter business. And your high paid surgeon would have not paid taxes on their income because they would have been able to invest in tax shelters and offset all of their income.
People always talk about the very high mid-century World War II, post-World War II income tax rates. But I think this is important because some of these were not actually as real by 1986
exactly,
as you look on a chart.
Exactly. So you had these high rates, but you had massive avoidance by high income earners. And the 1986 Act did something very interesting, and I think something that we should be doing today, which is it broadened the base by getting rid of those tax shelters. And they so effectively got rid of those tax shelters that we don't have them today, right? Our high income people with lots of salaries, they are paying lots of taxes. There's really very little reason or ways for them to avoid taxes. And they were a politically powerful group. So it can happen if you have people that really care about making it happen. It's not like it's impossible to make happen. And I think that that is the only way to go. Our only way forward as a country is if we figure out how to have a fair tax system. And I think that imperative, that moral imperative, is also a financial imperative, because right now our national debt is so great. Interest payments on the national debt are the third highest expense after Social Security and Medicare. It is. We are spending $1 trillion just to carry the debt this year, more than we're spending in the military. And, you know, that is not...
That's what you think. Trump wants to spend $1.5 trillion on the military this year.
Sustainable. So we're going to have to find a way to bring everybody into the tax system.
Sure thing, buddy.
And then always our final question. What are 3 books you recommend to the audience?
Okay. The first book is The Age of Extraction by Tim Wu. This is a fantastic book that talks about how many of our companies that used to do a lot of good for the world are now, rather than producing wealth, they are doing wealth extraction. And that's not good for any of us. And it's relevant for these issues of taxing individuals and taxing companies. The other is the book, The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order by Gary Gersel.
And I like this. All past guests of the show, Tim Wu, Gary Gersel. Yeah, I love these are great books.
Okay. That is a fantastic book. And I will say that the title is a bit daunting, but the book itself is so readable. And it makes this incredibly important point that the country used to have one vision of the role of government versus markets. And now we, through the rise of neoliberalism, it switched to this thing of it's all about let the market run free. But the point is that it is a fantastic illustration of the swings that can occur. And pendulums swing both ways, as we have seen loud and clear in recent years. And I think it's a really good reminder that when people despair of all of the problems of the day, there is an opportunity for pendulums to swing back and for better systems to take hold. And the last book is a book of fiction, the book Crossroads by Jonathan Franzen. Fiction at any time, and particularly in these times, is just a fantastic place to live, to explore other things than the world that we're living in. And I'd say Jonathan Franzen, better than almost anyone I know, presents people's internal psychological dramas. You feel like you're watching a documentary. His writing is so real. And my only disappointment is that I am waiting desperately for his next book to come out. This is Crossroads, is supposed to be the first book in the trilogy. And I'm sure I'm not alone in...
Don't start reading Game of Thrones.
Constantly checking for that second book to come up.
Ray Madoff, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have fixed the tax code.
We have fixed the tax code.
Is a VAT a form of tax? What about a tariff? My economics guy, Dad, said it's not a tax, but that is from my understanding. A tariff is absolutely a tax. It's an import tax. A VAT is also a tax on value added on stages of production. I think the U.S. is pretty rare in not having a VAT. It would be sexy if the next Democrat that came into office could somehow finagle a VAT while eliminating the tariffs so that the federal government could have a VAT to play with, but I just don't know. American people are fucking retarded. And nobody wants to talk about VATs. They just want to talk about billionaire taxes. But, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Not going to lie, I've made a lot of money during these 2 Trump months. I hope this happens every 12 months. LOL. I, too, am perfectly calling the peaks and valleys in the stock market. But for some reason, I only have $20,000 of gains to show for it. Okay.